This is Salman Rushdie.
Hi, this is Julia Sweeney.
This is E.O. Wilson.
Hi, this is Dar Williams, and you're listening to the
Humanist Network
Humanist
News.
Network
Humanist
News.
Network News.
Humanist Network News.
I ain't afraid of your Yahweh. I ain't afraid of your Allah. I ain't afraid of your Jesus. I'm afraid of what you do in the name of your God.
It's November 28th. You're listening to the Humanist Network News, an audio production by the Institute for Humanist Studies. I'm your host, Duncan Crary.
And I'm your host, Jess Constantine. For those of you joining us for the first time, humanism is a non-religious philosophy based on reason and compassion.
We've got quite a show lined up for you today.
Yes, we do.
Somehow we secured an interview with Philip Pullman, who's the author of The Golden Compass. You've probably heard of this fantasy novel. It's the first in a trilogy called His Dark Materials. There last night was the world premiere of the film The Golden Compass, the first installment of this series, starring Nicole Kidman and others. Mr. Pullman will be speaking about the world that he created, which is inhabited by spirits and talking animals and all sorts of fantastic creatures.
We also have James Howard Kunstler, author of The Geography of Nowhere and a leading critic of Suburban Sprawl.
In other words, he'll be speaking about a world we wish were fantasy.
So up first, we have British novelist Philip Pullman, who's most famous for his trilogy, His Dark Materials, which has won many prestigious awards in the UK. Now, unlike C.S. Lewis, whose fantasy series, The Chronicles of Narnia, which is heavily influenced by his Christian faith, Pullman is known as an outspoken atheist in Britain. Now, you might be familiar with the controversies surrounding the release of the movie, The Golden Compass. The Christian right is calling for a boycott of that movie because they're claiming that it feeds children with atheist and anti-Christian values.
Hey, Jess, let's play the trailer from that movie.
There is a world where witches rule the northern skies, where ice bears are the bravest of warriors, and where every human is joined with an animal spirit who is as close to them as their own heart.
Are we going to see the child?
I should think so.
But this world is dominated by the Magisterium, seeks to control all humanity, and whose greatest threat is a golden compass and the one child destined to possess it.
Matt Cherry, executive director of the Institute for Humanist Studies, interviewed Philip Pullman by telephone this morning.
Philip Pullman, thank you so much for finding the time to talk to Humanist Network News just one day after the world premiere of The Golden Compass. I'm a huge fan of your work, and I hope that through this interview, we can get some of our listeners to catch the Pullman bug too. We don't have long, so I want to focus on the humanist aspects of His Dark Materials, the trilogy that starts with The Golden Compass. When did you start identifying yourself as a humanist and why?
Well, identifying oneself as anything for a writer, for a novelist, is a perilous thing, because then you find yourself acting as a spokesman for this cause or that cause. I've always tried to avoid saying I am an agnostic, I am an atheist, I am a humanist, I am anything else, because that way you're limiting the way that your books are received, and I don't want to do that. I want people to I want to be a bit more democratic about it and let people discover for themselves what cause is being espoused, if a cause is indeed being espoused. I suppose some of my stories do espouse a particular cause. So I've always hesitated, really, before describing myself as anything, and that includes humanist. However, I can tell you when I began to believe that there was probably not any supernatural influence on the course of world events, and that was when I was a teenager, and I began to read a little bit of philosophy that I could understand, and read about science too, and to come to the conclusion that probably the stories I'd been told in church were not actually literally true. So I guess that my lack of religious belief dates from quite a long time ago now, over 40 years.
So how do your humanist views show themselves in His Dark Materials?
Well, I'm not entirely sure that the views that I express in there are entirely humanist. It's just a question of labels, you see. My interest, though, as a storyteller, has always been in human nature and in its relation to the world we find ourselves in, the universe, putting it most broadly of all. I think that's the proper subject for fiction of any sort, really. The tendency of the story, if I can put it like that, is to celebrate what makes us human, including, very much including, the intellectual curiosity, which has been so deplored by generations of Jewish and Christian religious people, because it is what led to the fall in the third chapter of the book of Genesis. Eve was tempted by the serpent, not by lust, not by greed or for money or anything else, but for curiosity. You eat the fruit, said the serpent, and you will grow wise. That was what tempted Eve. And I think we should put up statues to Eve. I think we should celebrate Eve. We should have a National Eve Day, because this act of curiosity was the first thing that led us away from being the pets of God, so to speak, the little creatures who were allowed to run about and have fun in his beautiful garden, and to become sort of fully autonomous human beings. Now, this is a myth. In other words, something that isn't literally true, but it's sort of psychologically true. And I see this as being almost the central human myth, which is why I was writing about it in my novel. It's also been written about, of course, in Paradise Lost by John Milton, and I'm sure many, many other stories, and will be told many times again. But that, for me, is the central human myth, because it's about how we become human, how we become fully ourselves, fully conscious, how we move away from the old idea that everything that exists does so because of a god or gods.
So, although you're reluctant to accept labels, it sounds like any work that really grapples with the human condition is bound to reflect, to some extent, the author's views about the human condition. And
oh, inevitably. When you do something, when you do a long, complex task that lasts you for 7 years, as writing this novel did, this long story in three volumes, you have to take it seriously or you can't do it. You can't do a trivial task for 7 years with all your attention and all your effort. It's not psychologically possible. So when you're putting all of yourself into something, then that something that's produced at the end of this long time and this immense effort will inevitably show the views you think important, because these will be the values and the views that have underpinned your the doing of the work. So I'm sorry to be sort of reluctant to accept labels, but one of the reasons for this is that I don't like telling people how to read texts. This is the sin that the fundamentalists commit, in my view. They say, you must understand this book literally. Of course, this business where it says, you know, you can sell your daughter into slavery, you can take that as a metaphor. But all the stuff about homosexuals, take that as literal. And, you know, that's the way homophobic and misogynistic fundamentalists behave. I don't want to tell anyone how to read my story. If they read it, I think, if they read it with an open mind, I think they will find the values in which I believe clearly present. But I'm not going to tell anyone in advance what those values are.
So do you feel, you just went to the world premiere of The Golden Compass, do you feel that the movie makers were literal enough or managed to capture those themes, the humanistic themes of the book?
Well, in the first part of the story, which is the film that's just come out as The Golden Compass, the story concerns the actions of a little girl who finds herself bound up in events much bigger than she could have dreamed of, because she, like Eve in the story, does something out of curiosity. She goes into a room where she's not supposed to be, and she overhears something she's not supposed to overhear, and it all follows from that. And they told the story really pretty well. I mean, the film has all sorts of cinematic virtues. It looks spectacular. The performances are wonderful, including that of the little girl who plays the central character. And the special effects, because it's that sort of film, are beautifully realized. But I was very pleased to see they told the story clearly and well. The first part of the story is fairly straightforward. It's fairly simple and straightforward to do that with. when they come to the second film and the third film, if they decide that they can go ahead and make the second and third films, we'll have to grapple more closely, I think, with the issues that the story does make Blaine.
Now, in the second and third books, there's a much stronger focus on the Authority, who is a god figure, and the rebellion against the Authority. And I know there was some concern in atheist circles that Hollywood was toning down or would tone down the anti-theistic elements by making it less obvious that the heroes are rebelling against God. Do you think this is going to be the case?
I don't know, because we haven't got there yet. Whether there's a second film and a third film at all depends on the box office for the first one. I mean, that was always the case. Everybody always knew that.
Well, one factor that may affect the box office is the boycott that's being urged by some Christian groups who are claiming that your work is anti-Christian or even more specifically anti-Catholic. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, that's correct. Well, I mean, it's correct that they're trying to organize a boycott. I think these people are... it's ridiculous. It really is absurd. They never learn. They never learn that if you want to draw attention to a film and make everybody curious to go and see it, then make a fuss about it. It always happens. Every single time they try and do this, they never learn. And the other thing they never seem to notice is that they are behaving exactly in the way I describe the religious authorities who've got their hands on political power as behaving. In other words, they're repressing argument, they're repressing freedom of speech, they're trying to prevent people from understanding things. They're doing exactly what I describe in the book. It's not surprising that they're creating a fuss. But I do wonder that they never learn that the result is always the opposite of what they claim they want.
Well, maybe they'd have to actually read your books to learn that they're acting in the way you describe, and I suspect many of them haven't read it.
Well, they dare not, you see. They don't like to put themselves in. They don't like to open their minds to things that are not exactly what they know they're going to be in advance.
So do you welcome this controversy because it attracts more attention to your works and more discussion of them?
I wish we all lived in a world where everybody was full of good intentions. But unfortunately, we don't. And while I would rather, of course, the making of the film could proceed without any pressures or any problems at all, and everybody would go and see it and love the films about it, well, it was probably bound to happen. It was probably bound to happen. I do have to say, though, in due deference to my American readers, this kind of intense reaction to religious questions only seems to occur in America. It doesn't, with the exceptions of Iran, Saudi Arabia, and probably Afghanistan under the Taliban, it doesn't occur anywhere else in the world, as far as I know. The rest of the world is pretty laid back about this sort of thing. But America was a nation founded, I suppose you could say, by the Pilgrim Fathers, who were the zealots who found England too lax for them and left to go and found a new nation somewhere else. And America's had a very intense and passionate and disturbed and almost frenzied at times relationship with religion ever since.
Philip Pullman, you were constantly compared to Tolkien and C.S. Lewis, who were both Christian apologists. Was his Dark Materials a conscious response to their work?
No, not a conscious response. There's an interesting difference between Tolkien and Lewis. Tolkien never mentions Christianity of any sort in his Lord of the Rings. He was a Catholic. And for him, all the big questions of life, what was right, what was wrong, what our duty was, what happened afterwards, all those things, were all settled already. The church had the answers. Now, Lewis, by contrast, was a Protestant, a Belfast Protestant, a Northern Irish Protestant, of the most intense sort. And initially, as I understand it, a very suspicious of Catholics. He used to call them bog trotters, which is the old insulting name for the Southern Irish. Lewis came from a tradition of personal argument and wrestling with conscience and reading the Bible and studying and praying earnestly by yourself. So the odd result is that the Narnia books, although I really dislike them for the conclusions they come to, nevertheless do touch on big questions of faith. Is there a God? If there is a God, what is he like? What would a false God be like? What must we do to be saved? Things like this, big, intense, earnest questions pounding away in these books. And I do respect him for tackling these questions, although, of course, I dislike the conclusions he came to. You don't find any of that in Tolkien. There's no doubt in The Lord of the Rings who's good and who's bad, or why they're good, or why they're bad, or what the good is. It's all there. It's all firmly settled, which is why I find, for all its enormous narrative complexity and intellectual underpinning, I find it a trivial work, whereas Narnia is not a trivial work, although I dislike it. So they're not, to lump them both together as Christian apologists is to mistake the very big differences between them.
So what is it you dislike about Lewis's conclusions, and how do your characters and conclusions differ from his?
What I dislike most of all is his fear and suspicion amounting to hatred of this world where we live. The extraordinary thing is that after taking his children, the heroes of the story, through these extraordinary and amazing adventures and in which they experience all kinds of things and presumably learn all kinds of things and presumably become wise as a result of experiencing all these things, it seems to me that the response that, for example, to name but one character, the result that Jesus would probably have approved of would have been to let them live and grow up and do good in this world, instead of which he kills them all in a railway accident and whisks them off to heaven, to somewhere else. It's as if he hates this world. And the other thing that I can't stomach is the exclusion of the girl Susan from whatever it is that the stable represents, salvation, I presume, at the end of the story, because she's growing up, because she's become too interested in invitations and nylons or something, lipstick and invitations and nylons. In other words, she, like any teenager of either sex, is discovering that her body is changing, discovering the effect her body has on others, discovering, becoming sexually aware. And this was so terrifying, so horrifying for C.S. Lewis that he denies her, he shuts her out. My sister is no longer a friend to Narnia, says one of the children. It would be tragic if it weren't so absurd. So those are the things I dislike about the Narnia books. I was trying in my story to show what a wonderful place the world is and how great it is that we have senses and nerves and emotions and so on.
So how does Lyra, your heroine, differ from Susan?
Well, Lyra grows up and she realizes that growing up is a difficult thing and it's full of trouble and conflict and some pain, but it is an important thing and a very great thing in the end. It's only through growing up that we can become wise. Innocence is not wise, and wisdom cannot be innocent. So we have to leave innocence behind, and that's where I differ from the Christians, who put such a high value on this thing they call innocence.
Speaking of Lyra, I have twin daughters, Sophia and Lyra, and of course Lyra is named after your heroine. So my question for you, Philip Pullman, is where did you get the name Lyra from?
Well, that's how nice to hear about your daughters. And Sophia, of course, means wisdom, which is what we're all striving for. Where I got the name from, it was a long-buried memory of my childhood when, as a pious little boy, I used to go to church every Sunday, my grandfather's church. He was a clergyman. And one of the hymns we used to sing, and I liked the tune of it, was the Easter hymn, which goes, Jesus Christ is risen today, hallelujah. And now, all the hymns in the hymn book had the name of the writer at the top of the hymn. It was Charles Wesley, or it was J.M. Neal, or somebody else. And the name at the top of this hymn is Lyra Davidica, and I thought it was the name of a woman who had written the hymn. Later on, of course, I discovered it meant the Harp of David, and it was a collection of hymns. Now, that a long-buried memory of that name, Lyra, liking it when I was a boy, sort of surfaced when I was when my character appeared to me, as she sort of did when I started writing the story. And I just picked the name out, Lyra. It's also the name of a constellation, of course, in the sky. It's also a name which enables me later on to rhyme it almost with Lyra, because Lyra is a liar in the story, and that's the technique, that's the strategy she's used to survive so far. But at one very crucial point in the book, she finds she has to tell the truth.
Thank you. It's great to get that explanation. Now, I've left one of my more difficult questions to last. Earlier this year, we interviewed another great humanist novelist, Salman Rushdie, and he said that non-religious language sometimes feels impoverished compared to religious language, the kind of religious language that Milton used so well. And I know Milton was a major inspiration for you.
Indeed.
And Rushdie posed a question for our humanist advice columnist, or agony aunt, as we would say in Britain. How can humanists create a language that is as rich as religious language? So how would you, Philip Pullman, answer Rushdie's concern?
That's a very good question, a very interesting question, and of course it deserves much more consideration than I can give to it now in a rather hasty ending to our interview now. I suppose that I, like he, have been trying to do that in my work, to find a way of describing the feelings that some people call religious, but I think are common to everyone, whether they're religious or not, feelings of awe and wonder at the mystery and the profundity of the universe itself, its beauty, its extent, its size, and so on. I tried to describe that a little in my story. Whether I've succeeded in doing so as well as the writers, you know, I don't know. That's for others to judge. But it is a consideration that we need to take on board, and it's very interesting that it should be put to you by Salman Rushdie.
Well, personally, I think both of you have done a great job of taking religious language rather than avoiding it, taking it and turning it to humanist themes. And I'd like to thank you for all of your work and for taking the time to talk with Humanist Network News.
Well, thank you very much for your questions. I appreciate what you're doing, and my very best wishes to your organization, and especially to you, to Lyra and Sophia.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to the Humanist Network News. I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your host, Duncan Crary. We just heard an interview with Matt Cherry and fantasy novelist Philip Pullman. Some of you humanists out there are probably scratching your head saying, what are they making a big fuss about all these fantasy novels with demons and ghosts and gods and goblins? Well, you'll be surprised to know that within Philip Pullman's fantasy realm, his books give scientific explanations for how these creatures came to be.
Even though Philip Pullman is well known for not believing in God, it sounds like he's against the use of labels like atheist and humanist, which is a similar point that Sam Harris, author of The End of Faith, brought up on our last podcast.
You can learn more about Philip Pullman and his universe by visiting philip-pullman.com.
And go see The Golden Compass. Comes out in the U.S. December 7th and in the U.K. on December 5th. My favorite thing that Mr. Pullman has said throughout this whole controversy is, my point is that religion is at its best, it does most good, when it's farthest away from political power, and that when it gets hold of the power to, for example, send armies to war or to condemn people to death or to rule every aspect of our lives, it rapidly goes bad.
Humanists are very concerned with the separation of religion and government. Here in Albany, New York, where the Institute for Humanist Studies is based, we've been lobbying very vigorously against a proposed Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which we're calling the Religious Excuse Act. The Institute for Humanist Studies is not anti-religion, but this bill essentially puts religion above the law and encourages people to break the law in the name of religion. We've been getting a lot of press attention for our efforts opposing RFRA. We also got some press attention in Time magazine.
Kudos, Duncan.
Thank you very much for our work to help educate children with humanist values.
You can read more about all of these things at our website, humaniststudies.org.
Before we play the second interview of today's program, Jess, do we have any listener comments?
Yes, we do.
Hello, this is Jeremy. I just wanted to say that my sister and I live in a small town in Illinois. And being atheists and not coming out with it is a lot harder, especially in a small town. My sister, in fact, is a teacher and at a public school, and occasionally the students had to pray there. And she fears for her job and therefore doesn't say anything about it. And I don't think this is taken into account by a lot of people. All right, thanks. Bye.
Thanks, Jeremy. That call was in response to last month's installment of Sweet Reason, our humanist advice column. Last month, Maureen Matsumara discussed coming out as an atheist to one's family and friends. And as she mentioned last week, and as Jeremy let us know, it's not always easy for everyone to be out as an atheist. So
if you have a question for Audio Sweet Reason, or if you'd love to leave us a listener comment, please do so by calling our toll-free number, 877-659-1515.
For the remainder of the program, we're going to hear from James Howard Kunstler, one of the leading critics in the world of suburban sprawl. James Howard Kunstler is the author of The Geography of Nowhere, The City in Mind, Home from Nowhere, and most recently, The Long Emergency. While humanists often speak about their views on religion, philosophy, separation of church and state, and science, one of the topics that doesn't often make the discussion is the human habitat. And it's actually a rather important part of humanism, because that is where we humans live, in the world that we make for ourselves. And according to Kunstler, we've made a real mess of it.
Duncan spoke with Mr. Kunstler in his habitat near Saratoga Springs last week.
James Howard Kunstler, something horrible has happened to the human habitat over the past 60 years. I wonder if we could begin this discussion by having you read a brief passage from the introduction to your 1993 book, The Geography of Nowhere.
I'd be pleased to, Duncan. Thank you very much. 30 years ago, Lewis Mumford said of post-World War II development, quote, "The end product is an encapsulated life spent more and more either in a motor car or within the cabin of darkness before a television set," unquote. The whole wicked, sprawling, megalopolitan mess, he gloomily predicted, would completely demoralize mankind and lead to nuclear holocaust. It hasn't come to that, but what Mumford deplored was just the beginning of a process that, instead of blowing up the world, has nearly wrecked the human habitat in America. Ever busy, ever building, ever in motion, ever throwing out the old for the new, we've hardly paused to think about what we are so busy building and what we have thrown away. Meanwhile, the everyday landscape becomes more nightmarish and unmanageable every year. For many, the word development itself has become a dirty word. 80% of everything ever built in America has been built in the last 50 years, and most of it is depressing, brutal, ugly, unhealthy, and spiritually degrading. The jive plastic commuter tract home wastelands, the Potemkin village shopping plazas with their vast parking lagoons, the Lego block hotel complexes, the gourmet mansardic junk food joints, the Orwellian office parks featuring buildings sheathed in the same reflective glass as the sunglasses worn by chain gang guards, the particle board garden apartments rising up in every meadow and cornfield, the freeway loops around every big and little city with their clusters of discount merchandise marts, the whole destructive, wasteful, toxic, agoraphobia-inducing spectacle that politicians proudly call growth. The newspaper headlines may shout about global warming, extinctions of living species, the devastations of rainforests, and other worldwide catastrophes. But Americans evince a striking complacency when it comes to their everyday environment and the growing calamity that it represents. I had a hunch that many other people find their surroundings as distressing as I do my own, yet I sense, too, that they lack the vocabulary to understand what's wrong with the places they ought to know best. That's why I wrote this book.
Mm. And then I marked another passage for you a little bit later on in the intro, if you could read that, please.
Okay. I suppose that my experience in suburb, city, and town life left me biased in favor of town life, at least insofar as what America had to offer in my time. That bias is probably apparent in the chapters ahead, but all places in America suffered terribly from the way we chose to arrange things in our post-war world. Cities, towns, and countryside were ravaged equally, as were the lesser order of things within them, neighborhoods, buildings, streets, farms, and there is scant refuge from the disorders that ensued. The process of destruction that is the subject of this book is so poorly understood that there are few words to even describe it. Suburbia, sprawl, overdevelopment, conurbation, Mumford's term, Megalopolis. A professor at Penn State dubbed it the Galactic Metropolis. It is where most American children grow up. It is where most economic activity takes place. Indeed, I will make the argument that this process of destruction and the realm that it spawned largely became our economy. Much of it occupies what was, until recently, rural land, destroying, incidentally, such age-old social arrangements as the distinction between city life and country life. To me, it is a landscape of scary places, the geography of nowhere, that has simply ceased to be a credible human habitat. This book is an attempt to discover how and why it happened and what we might do about it.
James Harrod Kunstler, thank you so much for reading that.
Oh, you're welcome.
You are probably the loudest critic of suburban sprawl.
Well, I'll try to whisper from now on.
Today, but I've heard you speak many times, and the you have visual images that are very important to your talk. I know we're on the radio here now, but so much of what you say about suburban sprawl and horrible architecture is very funny. And I wanted to, I mean, you have things like you refer to buildings as Darth Vader's helmet or the Death Star. And of course, with the picture on the screen, the audience goes wild.
Yeah, it's sort of a comedy act. It sort of evolved into a comedy act. But, you know, I was a theater student in college. That was my major, believe it or not. And I was exposed to Samuel Beckett at a tender age. And Samuel Beckett put it very well. He said, nothing is funnier than unhappiness. Mm. And, you know, so these environments cause us so much unhappiness, so much distress, that they're a source of comedy. When you see a Laurel and Hardy comedy from the 1920s, you know, these two morons, you know, hitting each other with 2x4s and dropping pianos on each other, or, you know, even a Tweety Bird cartoon, you know, you know, what we're seeing is people hurting each other, but we laugh. You know, getting hit by a 2x4 in reality is not a pleasant thing. In fact, it can kill you. Mm-hmm. But when you see it on stage in a film or something, it becomes funny because we identify with the pain of it. And so the pain of our everyday environments in America is so extreme. They're so bad. They suck so egregiously, you know, that all that's left finally is humor.
Yeah. What are some of your favorite one-liners you've come up with? I know you were talking about how Walmart and stores like Walmart always display a patriotic totem to warn off all criticism, which would be there's so many flags.
Yeah, the reason that we see flags flying over the Denny's restaurants is not because they really, you know, give a damn about the war in whatever country we're in at the moment. But it allows them to put up crappy buildings that can't be criticized. So the flag is a totem warding off criticism. And that's why we see so many of them, especially in front of the corporate headquarters. They always had the little ensemble, you know, of the three flags, the state flag, the town flag, and at center, the U.S. flag.
Mm-hmm. You've talked about how different building, like you can't see the Walmart from the Target because of the curvature of the earth.
Yeah, well, you just said it for me. Right, because, you know, the streets and then the parking lots are so huge, the scale is so huge that you end up feeling like you're in a surrealist painting, you know, that you can't find the horizon really, you know. Uh-huh. You're sort of lost in space out there. And to be lost in space is really extremely distressing. And one of the reasons that the whole success of urban design depends on defining space well is that people don't like to be lost in space. Mm-hmm. They like to know where they are. They like to know where things begin and end, mm-hmm. you know?
I heard you giving your TED talk. You had a picture of a street with two, you know, juniper shrubs or whatever, and in a bark mulch bed, and you described one as the mothership, and then R2-D2 and C-3PO.
Yeah, there were three of them. There was a big juniper shrub and two little junior ones, and yeah, they were exploring the planet to see if they could colonize it. But, you know, they were doing a chemical analysis of the bark mulch to see if they could live there. But, you know, that was a comment on the idiocy of our landscaping design, which tends to be used as a nature band-aid to mitigate the failures of our architecture, because our buildings suck so badly. Mm-hmm. You know, we think that if we stick a little, bark mulch bed with juniper shrubs in front of them, that makes it okay. Mm-hmm. But that gets back once again to this idea, which I think is really crucial to understanding this, that we have no confidence in our ability to create urban places. And so nature is always the default setting for the cure. And so where this stuff is concerned, you know, this is why you see so many stupid landscaping fantasias around American cities and suburbs, because our buildings are so bad, we're constantly trying to hide them behind, you know, beds of shrubs and crabapple trees and all that crap. And that's what we've been doing. We've had this idea that, you know, if you've got a wounded or maimed or mutilated city, the cure is nature. And it usually is delivered in the form of a nature Band-Aid, you know, a planting bed full of, you know, stuff. What you're basically seeing is also a very deep typological confusion over what is inherently urban and what is rural, between what is in the town and what is in the country, and what belongs where. And typically what this involves is people trying to ruralize the city. Mm-hmm. You know, if your city is bad, you try to cure it by bringing the country into the city. And now what we've demonstrated in about 50 years of doing this is that it's no cure at all. In fact, it only makes things worse. But it points out our complete loss of understanding of how these things work, especially typologically. The urban things belong in the urban places, and the rural things belong in the rural places. You know, one of the things about the word open space, I tell lecture audiences all the time, delete that from your vocabulary. Do not ask for open space. Do not ask for green space, because they are abstractions. And if you ask for it, an abstraction will be delivered in the form of a, you know, juniper shrub bed full of bark mulch. It's just, you know, or you'll get what you get frequently as a cartoon of the local surrounding countryside. Like around here, we like to put up a cartoon of the Adirondack Forest in the middle of the city. You know, they did that in the middle of Glens Falls. And one of the most crucial real estate parcels in the absolute center of town, where they allowed this UFO Burger King to land about 14 years ago. And it was obviously such a disgraceful building at the center of their town and so inappropriate that they then went out and spent about $1 million on landscaping to conceal it. Mm-hmm. So what they succeeded in doing was putting a cartoon of the Adirondack Wilderness around this inappropriate building in the very center of their town. And the last thing we need is a cartoon of the Adirondack Forest in the middle of the town.
After reading your book and hearing you speak many times, the word suburbia has come to take on a new meaning for me. My interpretation of suburbia is to disconnect elements of the world and isolate them. And by doing so, it's like severing the head from the body of a human being. We've done this to our communities. We've also done this to the way we think. Am I far out there, or do you agree with
that? Oh, no. It's one of the chief characteristics of suburbia is its disaggregation. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying desegregation, by the way. Disaggregation. Mm-hmm. The disassembly of the organs of civic life and then the consequent isolation of them, you know, mm-hmm. so that all the people live in one place, all the shopping occurs in another place, the offices are in a third place, mm-hmm. you know, the industrial stuff's in a fourth place, mm-hmm. and all of it can only be accessed by cars. It's just, it's not designed well. Right. It's poorly designed. Mm-hmm. It's designed only to satisfy the traffic engineers, really. You know, one of the great tragedies of the last, of the beginning of the 21st century is that our economy became about little more than building suburban sprawl. And this is an enormous problem because suburban sprawl is a living arrangement with no future. Mm-hmm. And you can state that categorically. And so what our economy has become is an organism devoted to building more stuff that has no future.
A guest that I had on this show last month, Richard Dawkins, made a bold statement once about how raising a child, identifying your child with a religion, is a form of child abuse. And I want to ask you, is raising your child in suburbia a form of child abuse? And maybe I should even say, is raising a teenager in suburbia a form of child abuse?
Well, it is a good point. I would hasten to say that, you know, I think we overdo the whole abuse angle a lot. We're kind of hysterical. We become hysterical Puritans in that sense in our time. But it may be a response to the fact that we are, in fact, inflicting a lot of damage on ourselves and find that we can't stop doing it. Mm-hmm. I mean, we can't stop inhabiting our suburban environments because we've invested so much of our national wealth in them. Mm-hmm. They're there. You know, the vast housing tracts and et cetera, they're there. And they are indeed very punishing for the development of children. Mm-hmm. You know, little children, you know, that is children between 5 years old and, let's say, 14, you know, they require certain things growing up in a human habitat that they don't get in suburbia. The main thing is that they need to develop this thing called their personal sovereignty, you know, the management of their own body in time and space. And that means, you know, learning to make their own decisions about, like, how to get home from school in time for dinner, mm-hmm. or how to get from school to the clarinet lesson and then back home again by their own devices without the assistance of somebody else. Now, this is something that, you know, the average eight or nine-year-old can learn how to do successfully. I learned how to do it in Manhattan when I was a kid. No problem. I got on a Lexington Avenue bus and I went up, you know, 20 blocks from my grammar school, went to my music lesson and got home by myself. But now the way that our towns are, you know, our suburbs are designed, you know, kids as old as 14 have to be ferried around, or 15 or 16 have to be ferried around by the family chauffeur. The upshot is they don't develop any ability to manage themselves in time and space. And that's a very fundamental thing. But it gets worse than that. You know, kids between the age of about 7 and 15 also have to learn a whole set of social skills, like how to spend money, you know, how to order food in a restaurant, how to behave in a public place. Mm-hmm. You know, the public places in suburbia are the leftover scraps, the berm between the Walmart and the Kmart. You know, and you know what kind of behavior goes on up there? Teenagers go up there and they torture kitty cats and they smoke, you know, animal tranquilizers and they make homemade tattoos and, you know, that's what happens there. But, you know, kids who grow up in a civilized environment, like, you know, a town that has actually integral parts to it where they can get from one place to another, you know, they go down to the coffee shop here in Saratoga. Mm-hmm. They're allowed in there, by the way. You know, there's no restriction on being a kid. You can go in with your girlfriend if you're 15 years old and, you know, or 16 and drink coffee. And, you know, you can't torture kitty cats and smoke, you know, crystal meth and do homemade tattoos in a coffee shop. Because if you do that, they throw you out. They ask you to leave. So kids experience that. They're socialized. You know, they begin to learn the social skills necessary to be adults, how to conduct themselves in public places, how to, you know, what not to do, and they successfully do this. In suburbia, they don't get that. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, what you get is just incredible, huge volumes of terrible behavior. And they're usually unsupervised. You know, there are no adults around to regulate, you know, torturing the kitty cats and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. You know, if there were sensitive adults around, that wouldn't happen. Mm-hmm. It ends up being a, you know, rather than an abusive environment, I would say an environment that does not successfully prepare kids to be successful, caring adults.
Well, let me ask you to describe to us a healthy urban block.
A really successful town is made up of integral parts. You know, you think of these as the organs of the larger organism of the city or the town. And these organs are, you know, the residential organs where the people live, the commercial organs where, you know, commerce and trade take place, the manufacturing organs, the civic organs where we have our meeting halls and our town halls and the police station, mm-hmm. The cultural organs of the museum and the school, etc. So you have these organs of the city, and they're deployed in an integral way so that things are connected seamlessly, so that most people can get to these things easily without prosthetic assistance, mm-hmm. namely the car, and in a way that makes it comfortable and indeed even beautiful, you know, that allows them to enjoy the journey from one organ to the other in a way that is psychologically rewarding. And of course, anybody who's been to a European city understands this. you know, you go to Rome, you go to Florence, you go to Paris, you go to, Munich, because they didn't throw their cities away the way we did. They didn't lose the integral nature of the true urban organism. Mm-hmm. And so you go around these places and you're going from, you know, the place that you're living or staying to the place where you're getting, you know, breakfast or coffee or going to an office or a museum or something. And the journey of going from point A to point B is very rewarding. You know, you're seeing things that were created deliberately to be beautiful, mm-hmm. to reward the human spirit. You're not encumbered by obstacles. You know, you don't have to cross an 8-lane freeway generally to get from one to the other. The main characteristic of a healthy urban organism is that it is scaled to the energy diet that is available to it. Now, unfortunately, much of the 20th century in America provided an energy diet that was really abnormal, because that was the height of the cheap oil fiesta and the cheap natural gas fiesta. And it allowed these sort of hypertrophic growth, a kind of abnormal hypergrowth of our cities, and then their, you know, the suburban asteroid belts that grew up around them. Mm-hmm. And we created these urban organisms that they're scaled to something that cannot be sustained. They outgrew any possible energy diet that they would probably be left with after the peak of the oil era. Mm-hmm. And when we entered that arc of decline, mm-hmm. which we're now entering.
This is Brendan Sheeran. I'm a director of the Humanist Association of Ireland, and you're listening to Humanist Network News.
I'm your host, Duncan Crary.
And I'm your host, Jess Constantine. We're listening to an interview with Duncan and James Howard Kunstler. Can't explain how they
love them all. In your book, Home from Nowhere, in the end, you have a personal note about yourself, and you mentioned that you're not religious, weren't raised in a particularly religious household, but what word do you use to describe the interaction between humans and their habitat? Do you use a word like spiritual well-being, or there's something intangible in the human essence that requires a certain bit of aesthetic appeal, or what term do you use?
I use a number of terms that I think explain, at least, you know, provide a framework for understanding this. You know, I think that our environment, I think that we are to some extent hardwired neurologically to feel either good or bad depending on what's around us. And that this tends to be universal in human beings. You know, there are variations, and some people feel claustrophobic when they're in spaces that are too defined, and some people feel agoraphobic when they're in places that are overly open. But, you know, I think the average person likes to feel secure within the boundaries of a coherent, comprehensible place. Mm-hmm. They like to know where things begin and end. They like to see the idea of order expressed in, you know, the rhythms and patterns of things in architecture. And that's why we have things like columns and pilasters and, mm-hmm. you know, and brackets and all this, you know, all these architectural adornments and devices, because they're not all ornaments. Some of them are structural things, obviously. I think that we need these things psychologically, and you could extend that, of course, to, you know, a kind of a spiritual realm, because I'm not a pure determinist or anything. Mm-hmm. I may not be religious, but I do think that we have a spiritual dimension to us, mm-hmm. and we do, you know, there is such a thing as beauty. Mm-hmm. There is such a thing as the tension of opposites. There's there are the deep mysteries of eros and eroticism and sex, which are not limited to sex, which actually extend into culture and inform a great deal of what comprises beauty for us. In fact, there's a wonderful book called On Beauty by Elaine Scarry. She makes the interesting point, which very few people have noticed, that one of the great crimes of modernist architecture is that it removed anything feminine from architecture. All the curves, you know, all the flowers, you know, anything that we remotely associate with female sensuality was deliberately left out.
Yeah.
And it's odd that even the women in our culture don't complain about that. You know?
But that's why you wrote The Geography of Nowhere, you said, to give people a vocabulary to complain about that.
Yeah. So, you know, so I've been trying to do that. So that's what I did. And, you know, we'll get beyond this, not because I'm complaining about it, but because circumstances are now developing that are going to compel us to do things differently, and we will. And it's going to change everything about how we live, and it's going to change our ethos and our aesthetic and our value system and our concept of who and where we are. We're going to be a very different people when we exit the cheap energy era.
I hear a lot of people talk about alternative fuels. I don't care about alternative fuels to the same degree, and I'll tell you why. Because I don't want to live in a world where I have to drive my car everywhere. I want to live in a well-designed world where I can live near where I work and I can enjoy recreation opportunities near where I work. And I feel like if they came up with some magic fuel to power everyone's SUV, I'm still stuck in this dystopian geography of nowhere. So I want to return to have you explain a little bit more about...
I want to talk to you about this question you've raised, because it's a very important one.
Okay, let's do that.
You know, unfortunately, there's a tremendous body of fantasy that is now has now grown among the American public about how we're going to keep on running our cars at all costs by other means than gasoline. Mm-hmm. And virtually all of these things now are fantasies. They're really very unreal. I mean, you can do them as science projects on a small scale, but they don't scale up to, you know, 200 million vehicles. You can run, you know, X number of vehicles on ethanol or biodiesel or, you know, French fried potato oil that's been used and thrown out. But can you run the entire U.S. automobile fleet and the interstate highway system in Walmart and Walt Disney world? You know, forget it. It ain't going to happen.
You've mentioned one of the main problems is that we're going to have to grow way more crops than we do now to create things like
that. The whole thing is just a total fantasy. You know, I mean, it's basically all these alternative fuels, as far as liquid fuels for cars goes, they're all net energy losers. They are not going to. And also, the way you've defined the problem is actually another layer of it that's much more important, which is we're right back into the diminishing returns of technology. Yeah. You know, if we enabled ourselves to drive our cars for another 100 years, we'd completely destroy the North America, not to mention the rest of the planet. Mm-hmm. So, of course, you know, this is self-evident. The thing that is, for me, the most painful is to travel among the environmental community, which I do a lot these days because I do a lot of college lectures and, you know, I go all around the country constantly and I'm rubbing elbows constantly with real high-toned environmentalists. And to an individual, they are absolutely preoccupied with finding some snazzy new way to run their cars. And they come up to me, you know, and they tell me that they just got a Prius. You know, they want me to pin a brownie point, give them a brownie point or pin a medal on them. Mm-hmm. And it drives me crazy because, you know, they don't seem to have any sense of consequence about, you know, what this actually leads to. If they would put a fraction of their mental energy into thinking about walkable communities or into really, you know, into retrieving really good urban design, we would benefit a lot more. Or if they put a tenth of their energy into the real important project that we face as far as transportation is concerned, which is restoring the American passenger railroad system at all levels, you know, that's what we really need. That's what we need the environmental people to put their energy into, not to spend all their time thinking about how we're going to run cars differently the way Amory Lovins does at the Rocky Mountain Institute. It has such farcical dimensions that it's almost beyond belief that this is what the intelligent minority of American people are preoccupied with.
Because I feel that environmentalists in America have also fallen under the plague of suburban thinking. They're isolating environmental
issues. Oh,
absolutely.
These guys, listen, to a person, these people want to live at the end of a 20-mile dirt road connected to their society by the umbilical cord of their car. But this gets to another thing that is essential about understanding the problem of suburbia. The great promise of suburbia, and one of the reasons that the environmental community is suckered into it, is that it promises to allow you to live and urban life in the rural setting. You know, one of the things that this represents is the fact that we have absolutely no faith in our ability to create urban environments at all. So the default setting for us now is that, you know, we have to live in the country or some cartoon version of it, because our ability to create cities is so bad. Our cities suck so badly. They're so unrewarding. They're so ugly. They're so poorly organized. They're so unintegrated. They're so psychologically defeating. They generate so much anxiety and depression, mm-hmm. that the default setting for the remedy for this is nature. We don't even want to think about what you know, a human construct could be that could be good. Mm-hmm. And so we put absolutely no effort into understanding how to do this. And that's one of the reasons that the environmental movement has been completely uninterested in urban design per se, because the human habitat doesn't interest them.
Right.
You know, and when I go around, one of the things that I notice that you know, is also disturbing is that the environmental community generally tends to view this thing they call the environment, with quotes around it, mm-hmm. as having value only for recreation or scenery.
Right.
I mean, they don't even value it for agricultural farm production. That says something about where we're at. And I hasten to add, I'm hammering on the environmental community here, but I'm a registered Democrat. You know, I'm not a neocon. I'm not a Republican. Mm-hmm. I'm not a conservative. I'm not a reactionary. But I think that the behavior and the ideology of the environmental community has been deeply out of sync with what we need to do in this country, which is to recreate a meaningful relationship between urban human habitats and a productive rural landscape, because we're going to have to produce our food differently in the future too. Industrial agriculture in this country is going to fail, along with all the other things that are dependent on cheap fossil fuels. I'm convinced that the disorders of the 21st century are going to return us to a lot of things that we used to do better, including designing better buildings and better towns.
Do you have any advice for our listeners as to what to do?
You bet. And the main thing is this, you know, the same thing that I tell college audiences who universally say, can't you give me some hope? You know, first of all, you know, I think I'm a very cheerful, upbeat person. I'm not necessarily a rosy-eyed optimist, but, you know, I'm a happy person. And, you know, I believe that we're going to continue on. You know, the kids complain that they want hope. And I'm not a hope dispenser, you know, to passive consumers of hope. But what I tell them is that, you know, the main thing that distinguishes, I think, a successful adult from a child is that an adult knows the difference between wishing for stuff and making it happen. There's a whole long list of intelligent things that we can respond to this set of circumstances with. You know, we need to be out there actively fixing our civilization, reforming the way we do our farming and our commerce and our schooling and our trade, and building our cities and designing our homes and our buildings and all the things that are necessary to be part of a civilization. We're going to have to put a lot more thought and a lot more work into that. And as we do that, you know, I'm serenely convinced that we will become a much more hopeful people. In fact, if anything, you know, all the marvels and technological miracles of the last 100 years have only ended up producing a society which is profoundly unhappy, depressed, and anxiety-ridden. So we really have nowhere to go but up from here.
James Howard Kunstler, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today.
It's been a pleasure, Tom.
That was Duncan interviewing James Howard Kunstler, author of The Geography of Nowhere and A Long Emergency. His website is kunstler.com, KUNSTLER.com. So Duncan, that was a house interview. Can you tell us anything about Mr. Kunstler's house?
Well, I can tell you that it's decorated with original artwork, paintings of McDonald's, gas stations, and burned out abandoned cars.
Why am I not surprised?
I spoke with James Howard Kunstler about a number of topics, including that one. They didn't make it into this show, but I'll probably be posting some of those extra interviews on our website in the Web Extras section at humaniststudies.org/podcast.
Also on that page, you can download episodes and read transcripts from previous shows. To leave a listener comment, please call our toll-free number 877-659-8255. 1515.
The use of our theme song, I Ain't Afraid, was generously donated by Holly Near. You can learn more about her music at hollynear.com. I'm your host, Duncan Crary.
And I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
Thanks for listening.
The Humanist Network News podcast is made possible by the Institute for Humanist Studies, a nonprofit think tank that promotes the philosophy of humanism.